The following talk was given by Jed Larson at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 7, 2021. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to see everybody. Well, this Sunday, I wanted to bring in a collection of different sources for to look at, basically around a short phrase, up and down. And I was familiarized kind of with this term during a study group that we had about a year ago with, it was Wednesday evenings. And we are using a book called Living by Vow by Shohaku Okamura. So it just popped into my mind as an interesting phrase to take a look at. I'll be using a quote from the book that we're using on Thursday, the Thursday study group, and that's The Zen Teachings of Homeless Kodo. So this is a 20th century Japanese teacher, Kodo Sawaki. And then that book, Living by Vow, another Japanese-born teacher, Shohaku Okamura. I'll be quoting that a little bit. Also a little bit of Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dhammapada, which I think quite a few of you know. The Dhammapada is a very old teaching, a Buddhist teaching from the Pali Canon. So those are quotes attributed to the Buddha. So I'll bring those in and just a little bit here. But first I wanted to start with a quote from Sawaki Roshi from that book, the Zen Teachings of Homeless Kodo, Kodo Sawaki Roshi. And it's a recollection of his. He says, during World War II, when I lived, when I visited a coal mine in Kyushu, they allowed me to go into the mine. Like the miners, I put on a hard hat with a headlamp and went down the shaft in an elevator. For a while, I thought the elevator was going down very fast. Then I started to feel as if it were going up. I shone my headlamp on the shaft and realized the elevator was still going down steadily. When an elevator starts descending with increasing speed, we feel it going down. But once the speed becomes fixed, we feel as if the elevator were rising. The balance has shifted. In the ups and downs of life, we're deceived by the difference in balance, Kodo says, Sawaki Roshi. He says, in most cases, our ordinary way of thinking only considers differences in balance. But I think this short excerpt is addressing is our tendency to try to orient ourselves in our life by means of the relative world. So we'll be negotiating the different things that are happening in our world. And essentially, the point of reference is kind of this array of different things that we're dealing with in life, and very naturally, different expectations and preferences come up. And I think that's what Sawaki is pointing at here, this relative world that we often try to orient ourselves to. And he's kind of alluding to balance there, our interpretation of which way we think things may tend to be going at a certain point in our life or at a certain moment in our life. And it's all really based on that relative view. Okamura in Living by Bao kind of elaborates on this a little bit, I thought. He says, when we are successful, we think, yeah, this is great. When we have a hard time, we feel small. This up and down is samsara. This is our life as a human being. So again, a picture of human experience of ups and downs. I think we can all relate to the different things that can be extreme or just mild sort of movements in our life. For me, it reminded me of the teaching of the wheel out of kilter. Maybe you've heard that. It's a way of describing this term dukkha that we hear in teachings of the Buddha. And dukkha represents, or is often translated as suffering, but I think it's addressing the entire spectrum of human experience. So it's preferences, suffering, in this case, the images of a wheel out of round. So you get an idea of maybe kind of just an unsteadiness or something that feels not quite steady somehow. I think it's an interesting image. I think it's a very helpful one, this out of round wheel, to describe how life can end up feeling to us a lot of the time. In one way I was thinking of it is that it doesn't necessarily have to be seen as something negative. I think of maybe if we feel sluggish or we just are having kind of a sedentary life, we'll feel maybe a lack of energy. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just in that case, recognizing maybe that we need a little more exercise to kind of find a healthier way of living. I think this phrase, this way of describing dukkha is kind of similar in that way, in that it's not necessarily making a judgment about anything, but just speaking more to a recognition of a different way, you know, kind of like in the example of exercising, that there's something else that we can do or recognize to, in the end, clarify what this relative world is, to help understand what suffering is and to understand the alleviation of suffering. Okamura goes on and he says, as we move in samsara, this up and down, we always feel somewhat unsafe, somewhat unsettled. Something is lacking, even if we are in the heavenly realm and all our desires are fulfilled. Of course, if we are in hell, we really suffer. And he's using the terms heaven and hell here just as images, nothing literal there. So if our lives are not going well, or if they're going well, I think is all he's saying here. The Dhammapada, I found a verse from the Dhammapada. Again, those are quotes attributed to the Buddha, number 186. The Buddha says, there's no satisfying worldly desires. They give little satisfaction and much pain. Having understood this, the wise person finds not delight in heavenly pleasures. So again, I think this is related to what Okamura was saying about, even if we feel that things are going quite well for us, we can often feel a sense that there's something lacking, something that's just a little bit still not totally settled. I think of maybe being in what seems like a heavenly realm, and I'll maybe realize that I'm taking a little bit more than my fair share. So you think of an example like that where things really seem quite nice, pleasurable, but there's just something, maybe we're not quite at peace with whatever activity that we're doing. Again, if we're taking a little bit more than our fair amount. The Buddha says that there's no satisfying worldly desires. I think of the hedonistic treadmill. As Americans, I think we probably can recognize this going on. I mean, it's a huge scale, basically. Some people seem to be really caught up in it, but I think it applies to almost everybody. And goes to show that there can often be the sense that there's something just a little bit better we'll want to go after. We kind of, you know, like what we have for the moment, but we'll always be chasing after that next thing. That's just the nature of craving and grasping. It's almost like we're chasing after a shadow. It's always going to be leading out in front of us. We'll never actually catch up, is what the Buddha is trying to point out to us here. I don't think at the same time that these teachers are saying that we can't enjoy life either. But it's more about understanding the nature of grasping and why these things like the hedonistic treadmill actually come up for us to understand. But then also to find a life that is unswayed by our desires, that's unaffected by whatever situation we might be in, to the sense that we're really struggling to try to escape from it rather than stay here and take care of our life that's directly in front of us. Because I think in the end, there is really no way to escape our life. There may be different ways that we can kind of distract ourselves from different difficulties that come up. But these teachers are, I think, trying to help us see that it's the running away that is causing the suffering. It's, and from there, I think that can help us realize that what we're actually doing is just grasping at different ideas. You know, the idea of something better that I can run away to, or the idea that I can keep this thing that I like. It's interesting that we use the term ideal to describe things that are optimal for us. And right there, I mean, it's the word idea is, you know, like smack right in the middle of that term. It's, I think, revealing that what we really are kind of interested in, if we take a close look, is the idea. And we're really drawn to that. And that's what is happening through our activity of just staying in this relativistic world, is that we're not actually chasing after the real things that we think we are. What we're actually doing is just chasing after ideas. And it's not so much to try to create a gloomy picture or anything, but again, back to that example of just recognizing that there's a way to actually clarify what that is. And also that if grasping is happening, that's that very grasping is kind of our way to realize also. That's providing us the opportunity to see what is happening in this moment. So it's not necessarily that craving and grasping are bad things at all. It's the necessity of this here now experience that we can actually wake up to. Shohaku Okamura has a pretty striking statement here. He says, it's important to see that it's not life that causes suffering, but our expectations that life should be the way that we want. We can't live without expectation, but if we can handle the feelings caused by the difference between our expectation and reality, that's liberation. So, like reading that, it's not life that causes suffering is a little bit shocking to hear in some ways, because so often we're looking outward to try to identify what assails us. But I think it's an important message here that Okamura is bringing, in a kind of a quite unique one, something that we don't hear too often. It's kind of a message that this, unsettledness, we talked about the wheel out of round. It's almost like we are interpreting the unsettledness to uneven ground, something out there. So a statement like this, I think, is a way to, again, clarify what is actually happening. It's not externals. It's not a bumpy ground, but it's this out of true quality that we need to, that we'll be helping ourselves by taking a look at. All along, though, I think we can still recognize that there indeed is a lot of suffering going on in the world. So I think it's important also to be able to read this statement that it's not life that causes suffering, and then also be able to know that there are many things in the world that need resolving. So it's not making a statement necessarily about the wider world. I think a statement like this is trying to help us focus in on a way that we'll interpret things, thinking that if, I think it's helping us see that our expectations will always be moving in terms of what we think a perfect world is. They'll always be shifting. So since that is the case, we won't actually find resolution from suffering in expectations of how we think the external world, how other people should be, and maybe how to try to control them. The alleviation of suffering is from understanding expectations. So with expectations, judgments, valuations, I think can sense agitation in that frame of mind. It's another aspect of what Okamura is saying here. And that actually we will not find satisfaction in trying to manipulate the world in a way that is according to our ideas, but actually the satisfaction is in just taking care to our best ability of this world that we're living in right now, our immediate experience, our immediate environment. Thich Nhat Hanh, I think, has some nice quotes that feed are going to interweave into this a little bit. He says, Let's see here. When we are able to identify our suffering and see its causes, we will have more peace and joy. and we are already on the path to liberation. So when we are able to identify our suffering and see its causes, we will have more peace and joy. And we are already on the path of liberation. That term already, I think, is a little bit of a clue too. Right there in addressing our suffering, not labeling it or coming up with some idea about it, but just, again, taking care of our life already, just in that immediate action of taking care, I think it's possible to sense a more settled life. It also, to me, it's communicating that it's not just about our own suffering. That's, I think, a particular quality that Thich Nhat Hanh has, that it's conducive for the peace of the entire picture, basically, not just our own situation. He says, when we direct our attention towards our suffering, we see our potential for happiness. We see the nature of suffering and the way out. That is why the Buddha called suffering a holy truth. When we use the word suffering in Buddhism, we mean a kind of suffering that can show us the way out. So again, to see suffering as this kind of desire for escape, a desire for something else, almost like a never-ending something else-ness. And I think Thich Nhat Hanh here is saying that suffering is not something to try to escape. Actually, the opposite here. He's saying when we direct our attention towards our suffering, we see our potential for happiness. I think about, in some sense, how suffering doesn't necessarily have to be exactly how it's felt in a moment. You think about examples of people getting into highly undesirable situations in order to help somebody else out. You know, somebody jumping into cold, icy water to help somebody back to the shore. I think perhaps in a case like that, the aversion that would happen normally of being in that situation would be pretty strong, but maybe that person's not really sensing the suffering in the same way. It's has a broader feeling to it somehow, maybe, that we're trying to help each other out. There's a certain kind of distress, maybe, or that's probably not the right word, but just a caring feeling amidst suffering, amidst this sense of need. Thich Nhat Hanh, I think if you've heard him talk, you've probably heard him mention the boat people. These are refugees. Primarily, I think he, when I've heard him talking about it, it was probably the 70s and 80s, where people from Vietnam were fleeing in boats to China to escape a war-torn area in Vietnam. And there's plenty of examples of how Thich Nhat Hanh has this wisdom of seeing suffering on a sort of beyond the borders, maybe what we would normally think of as suffering, to seeing a big picture of humanity. Katagiri Roshi has I'll quote a section here from You Have to Say Something, I think touches on this as well. Katagiri Roshi says, if we observe the human world closely, we can hear a very deep sound. It is a kind of voice, yet it is voiceless. If we are very quiet, we can hear this voiceless voice in the bottom of the human heart. Wherever you may be, whatever you experience, if you are present, you will immediately hear it. But you can't hear it with your ears. Does it express pleasure? Is it sad? Is it good? You can't evaluate it. It is just there, and you are there too. Whether you are in the middle of success or failure, your life cries. So these are the cries of the world that Katagiri is talking of. He says, compassion is always with us, but ordinarily we let our heads come first. So this cry of the world is Thich Nhat Hanh being kind of in that boat with those refugees, Thich Nhat Hanh getting outside of himself and feeling something that Katagiri Roshi is talking about here. We can't really evaluate what suffering is. We feel a desire to address it. I think a healthy desire to address it. But then also to know that it's not like a normal solution that we would, a problem and solution type of thing that we would kind of have an idea about. But it's something that is always going to be here that needs to be, again, taken care of. They try to take up an activity that's conducive to awakening, I think is what Katagiri is getting at. I thought I'd talk a little bit about the troubles of the world is how I labeled this next section, because I think that comes up in our mind in terms of understanding suffering. And obviously I think we feel a great deal of importance around how things are going in the world. From Okamura's book, Living in Vow, Okamura quotes the Samantabhadra Sutra, which says, the ocean of all karmic hindrances arises solely from delusive thoughts. Here, this is a teaching, I believe, of intention. So you hear that term karma, that means intentional action. It says that karmic hindrances arise solely from delusive thoughts. It doesn't say some of it, it says all arises from delusive thoughts. So karma is this intentional action. I think it's a teaching that helps us address the predispositions that we have towards life. So again, this trying to create a center of balance based on a relative view will always be unsteady. Those predispositions of moving this way or that way will be the human life of up and down. That's just necessarily what it is. At the same time, delusive thoughts, I think, point to enlightenment. If we look closely, that's exactly the reality that we may be living in. Confusion, you know, I don't think it's probably too helpful to you know, it's not helpful to judge ourselves or label ourselves at all, but to take an honest look at what confusion is and to be, you know, okay, and not to, again, judge ourselves, but to understand that in a way we kind of need delusion in the sense that we need exactly what is happening right now. We need, you know, just to kind of think of that lightly, we don't, the idea of me needing something is, there's problems with that, but because we don't find permanence anywhere, but this moment, if it's confusion, is exactly what we can work with to break through what sort of magnetic field that we have towards relativistic ways of seeing things. Okamura says, when we do, even when we do good things, we may create karma. Almost all of our actions are based on self-centeredness. Therefore, they are not in accord with the reality of oneness, impermanence, and interdependent origination. So I think we could probably be honest with ourselves and know that we never can really know whether something is good. Maybe we kind of be good in one situation, but from another person's view, it may not necessarily be so. So this is about seeing that good and bad, just seeing it directly as evaluation. That's what it is. Valuation is delusion, basically. Not basically, it is. So it may seem like using good and bad would be a way to address, or it would be the way to, you know, carry out things in a moral way. But seeing this nature of valuation in good and bad maybe helps us set that down a little bit and just take care. Instead of doing valuations of good and bad, just take care of our situation. I think of maybe we would get a gift from somebody and, you know, it's a pair of homemade socks or something. And we, you know, it just seems like we wouldn't necessarily just put them on and go walking outside with them. It's not a matter of saying that it's good or bad. We just know how to take care of that handmade thing that somebody spent a lot of time creating for us to give us. So it's more about just a sense of immediacy and being attentive and not, I think it's pretty natural to know how to avoid things that are harmful without making too much evaluation, without needing much evaluation at all. I think we can practice less egoism in a way, less selfishness, less desire, but maybe to see that not necessarily as following a specific rule to create some outcome, but more just doing those things as an anchor for our attention in this moment. Just know that we can always come back to less desire as opposed to what would normally be happening. If you sit in meditation and you notice the chattering mind, you notice that this choosing mind comes up quite easily. So if we take up an activity of selfless action, that's kind of a way, you know, that can be the activity of our life. We can carry on in that way. So there's a bit of a choice there, I think, but I think it could be just a down-to-earth type of activity that we pick up. Well, Kimura says, let's see here. Any actions, karma. So any action, intentional action, that's essentially all human action. So any actions caused by our ignorance of the reality of life are a hindrance because they prevent us from awakening to reality and liberating ourselves from self-clinging. Any activity we do solely for ourselves, for our family, community, or nation, including Buddhist practices, can be a hindrance to actualizing total interpenetrating reality. A pretty strong image here of watching out for getting caught up in our idea of what we think good is. There can be some pretty disadvantageous things to get into and not even know it. So even what we think of Buddhist practice, if we take that up in a selfish way, it could be something that's much different than what the Buddhist teaching is trying to point out to us. And I think this is just a way of, you know, all these teachings are just a way of, again, it's just maybe an honest look at how we tend to prioritize different things in our life and to know that it's possible to simply rededicate ourselves in each moment to come back to this moment. I mean, this is where the entirety of life unfolds. It'll never be any different than that. So we can choose to make our priority thinking about the future and the past and so forth. And if that comes up, that's perfectly fine. Just notice that right now. Don't judge yourself. Dedicate to reminding oneself to come back. Okamura goes on. He says, wars, ecological destruction, and so on have been caused by sincere, brilliant people under the banners of justice, liberty, human welfare, and national prosperity. So again, some pretty strong statement here for us to take into account. I think he's simply saying that rationalization is extremely swift and it's pretty sly too. And we can use our ideas to justify different things. I think about my own situation where I'm more comfortable doing things a certain way, getting my products in a certain way, and not seeing sort of ecological ramifications from things like that. And so then maybe I'll start to judge myself a little bit, but then I don't then notice that that's probably not too helpful. All that was needed there is just to recognize how my actions might be creating some problems somewhere, and then just try to make a little bit of a correction there. Again, it's just about paying attention to our life, and being sincere with ourselves and other people, and not judging. I think the teachings also try to portray to us a kind of hands-off type of feeling, a activity that causes less problems, which for me is kind of a bonus because I think of myself as kind of a lazy person a little bit. So it's like I can realize that it's a little bit easier to just take my hands off and not try to control. And then so there's that side bonus of knowing that I'm probably not creating as much problems for other people if I'm interjecting myself egoistically into their life. I think of wise people, examples of different people. And it seems like just so often they have that character to them that there's this gentleness. There's not a sense of control, I think, usually from folks like that. It may be kind of incisive. I think of these teachings by Okamura as being quite incisive, really cutting through and helping us. Yet there's no sense of him having any desire to try to control other people at all. Part of that wisdom in this broader sense of understanding turmoil in the wider world is also really getting a clear understanding that other is not actually other. I think there's a clarification of knowing that self is not self the way we think it is, but that can take some weight off of the judgments that happens that we may have on other people, to know that the truth of reality is that other is not what we think. Direct experience will show us the truth of what is happening, not ideas of self and other and valuation. In that same book, Okamura quotes the Buddha, who says, "A proponent of the Dharma does not dispute with anybody in the world." Another, I pick kind of strong quotes here. I think this teaching is aligning with a quality of Buddha Dharma that says that there's nothing that you could ever say that is absolute truth. And I think it's equating to us that this has broad implications in terms of, say, me trying to impart my ideas on other people. To the degree that I really am holding strongly to those, the natural outcome of that, I think, is probably going to be turbulence. If we have a much lighter approach to our own ideas, we see the limits of that relative truth, whatever ideas that we're holding, then maybe we can communicate some different way to other people. And I think what is actually being communicated there maybe is not so much the idea, but an open-mindedness, you know, like an exchange of different ideas without insisting on anything. And to finish up here, I have a few quotes from the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is quotes attributed to the Buddha. They're very old teachings. Historically, very old, but they're really quite wonderful. There's a wide variety. Some kind of seem almost proverb-like, and others are about as kind of core feeling in terms of Buddhist understanding. The three Dharma seals are in there, which is speaking of the Anatta doctrine, not self. And I mean, you can't really get any more core than that. So like core understanding of Buddhism. So it's this great variety of teachings in the Dhammapada. Here the Buddha says, "Happy indeed we live, friendly amidst the hostile. We dwell free from hatred." And this next line, I think, clarifies that. It says, "Happy indeed we live, friendly amidst the afflicted, afflicted by craving. We dwell free from affliction. So that hostile world, we clarify that and see that there's this craving that's happening in the world. And really that seems to take the weight of judgment off. So it's a way of addressing our own confusion, knowing that we'll probably end up creating turbulence if we don't really know our own suffering. Even if we do know our own suffering, we'll never know the suffering of other people, but we can know that we're all in the same boat. The Dhammapada says, one who, while seeking happiness, does not oppress with violence other beings who also desire happiness. One who does this will find happiness hereafter. You hear kind of a sense of we in both of these. We dwell free from affliction. This recognition that everybody desires to be free from suffering, or to clarify what suffering is, not necessarily to escape suffering, but to clarify the human situation. So this we, I think, is saying not really like togetherness necessarily, but to see through the idea of separation, to know that the fragmented world, that outside hostile world, all of those are limited ideas. So we can deal with the suffering. I think the Sangha also says to us, it's almost, I think of that quote from Okamura saying that, let's get that right. It's not life that causes suffering. In light of these quotes from the Dhammapada, it's not life that causes suffering, I think also communicates that regardless of what we think the situation is, we can also deal with what is happening. So in other words, if we're operating from an idealistic way of solving the problem, we'll always have difficulty. You know, we'll always want to be escaping that, basically. But knowing this clarity of what suffering is allows us to work in difficult situations and perhaps have a different understanding of what suffering is. Something that can be beneficial for people. And the Buddha says, it's hard to be born as a human. Hard is the life of mortals. Hard is it to gain the opportunity of hearing the sublime truth. And I think it's in some ways not easy or difficult, but to remind ourselves that we can be kind with ourselves, not to dismiss problems, keep an open eye for maybe how we even may be interpreting the teachings in an egoistic way, or taking a practice that is sort of pointing back towards us instead of being more open. And to take care, to take great care instead of taking efforts to continually think about or expect things to be a certain way. To put our energy into taking care instead of continuing to fuel thinking. Just coming back to this moment. Thich Nhat Hanh, just to conclude here, quotes a Vietnamese master, Tran Thai Tong, who says, with every step, you touch the ground of reality. So it's a practice of clarifying what up and down is, clarifying, you think of that example of going down in the elevator and not really even knowing which direction we're going because we're trying to find a center of balance in a relative sea of ideas. That actually can be much more simple than that, much more immediate. And that there can be a steadiness from knowing what is actually true and real. It's always right here, this vivid experience. The truth of that is expressing itself always for us, and we can stay with that. That's pretty much all I have for today. There's a few minutes left if people have any questions at all, or if you have any thoughts or comments. It's kind of a big variety of quotes there, but I thought they kind of tied together in a lot of different ways. It's interesting to see how different teachers, different traditions are all saying the same thing, and how kind of they have such a different feeling to them a lot of times. I really appreciate it. Like Okamura, I picked these incisive quotes, but generally I would say he is really has a gentle quality to him, which just goes to show that I think the Buddhist teachings can be presented both with a very clear and strong message, and it's not contradictory to sort of a gentle approach either, that those are complementary. They're actually the same, expressing the same wisdom. But those incisive quotes really, I think, equate to us that these teachers really think that this is important. They're really putting their whole life into this, and they don't hesitate to say something that shocks us if they think it will help. So, let's see, we have one chat. I think it's from Steve Tushak. I think he sent it directly to me, so I'll just read it real quick. Yeah, he's just referring to Crooked Cucumber, which is another great book. And Suzuki talks about how we think pain is bad. Suffering is bad, but Suzuki has just so many great ways. You probably recognize the teaching of weeds of our practice, where Suzuki says that they enrich our practice. So suffering seems bad, weeds seem bad, so many different things seem bad, but these teachers have a way of saying, well, probably not worth coming up with a strong conclusion about anything one way or another. Certainly, the idea of enlightenment can be a gigantic hindrance as well, or, you know, anything can be when we solidify it. Yeah, Ron, my I think my he's saying that the cabinets behind me are green. I think my computer is messing with the color a little bit, so I apologize. Have to try to fix that up. So, I don't see any hands, so it's great to see everybody. Hope everybody's staying warm. At least in the Midwest here, it's a little chilly, so we're feeling a little jealous of people in the southern areas. So great to see everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.